Where did the time go? How could it be that long ago? We remember it so well, the stories we could tell. Where did the time go? Where did the time go?
This is the Alembic Files. Eric the Blacksmith is back, and this one's going to be Phantasms 12. I think what we're going to talk about is something that I'm also doing something with, I mean, topically, with Bill Johnson and Theo, with regard to the mythos, the Christian mythos, with America, that is, that the country is supposed to be Christian, that kind of mythos, and also the mythos that Christians believe this country has special favor with Jehovah. This does not come out of the Bible. It comes out of our propaganda that we've had in the public school systems for quite some time. I'll say no more than that. Eric, welcome back. And, yeah, take it away. I mean, you found some stuff on your own, which kind of reinforces where I've been going. And independently, I'm glad that you came, not to the conclusion, but that you dug up the information you had and found yourself really kind of moonstruck.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Al. Geez, we're up to a dozen already. Wow. Where's the time go? It's good to be back. And, yeah, I found some pretty interesting stuff and what I consider to be a smoking gun as to the study of this country and how, in many cases, at least me, I was taught in school that this country was founded on Christian principles, and I think that we've grown up with a lot of myths, and the myths have been reinforced through the state education system and even in the parochial school system, you know, given the connection to that little nation state in Rome, which I do have a quote about, and we've talked about in the past, and I know you've talked about this with Theo, that many of these shows, conspiracy theorists, whatever you want to call them, the patriotards, I like to call them that, they like to blame the Jews for everything. They like to blame the Zionists for everything. Well, I do have a quote here from William Sutton, author of the New Age Movement and the Illuminati 666. I'm not too familiar with William Sutton, but I'd like to get more familiar with some of his works.
Okay, that's the working title again. Would you give that one more time?
The New Age Movement and the Illuminati 666.
Right, and I hate to kind of bust you on this, but do you have the publishing date for that?
When it came out? I don't. No, I don't. I'll try to get that to you. In fact, if I can find it while we're talking, that would be cool. So anyway, this is what he says, and actually, I'm not sure if this is attributed to William Sutton, but it is a quote. Quote, "Why would the Jesuits use their implacable enemy, the Jews, to further their designs for world domination? The Jesuits never do anything out in the open where they can be exposed. If they are recognized as the culprits, they will be blamed and suffer the consequences. But if they can use someone else as the cause of the world's problems, especially an enemy they can destroy in the process, then they have simultaneously accomplished two of their objectives. The Jewish people are the perfect scapegoat. Since the Rothschilds are Jesuit agents operating under a Jewish cover, using them, that is, the Rothschilds, informing the Illuminati back in 1776, effectively throws the onus of this conspiracy on the Jews. The Rothschilds are certainly not the only Jesuit agents that operate under a Jewish front. History books will the French Revolution first began in 1787 or 1789, depending on which book you read. However, it was actually planned by Jesuit Dr. Adam Weishaupt and the House of Rothschild almost 20 years before the Revolution took place." Unquote. Now, these are two separate paragraphs, two separate quotes. Like I said, I'm not that familiar with Sutton's work, so I'm not exactly sure where in the book, which edition, date, or anything like that that they originate from. But it's certainly, to me, some pretty telling words, because I think that that has happened. I mean, look in nature at the efforts of many species to employ camouflage. And I think that's what these societies, particularly the Jesuits and the Vatican, have employed brilliantly. They have employed camouflage.
You'll find the people that are most acrimonious toward the thought that Rome has been running the show with its proxies for time immemorial. I mean, they're usually those who want to pin everything on the Jews, and of course they'll call us, you know, Jew lovers and Zionists and all this other stuff. And I mean, and I've been through this before. I mean, I'm neither, but I can't see bashing some people. I mean, basically, it's, first of all, it's racism. Second of all, it's so distastefully part of Nazism, which, by the way, is over here now. That it's insensate. I mean, some of the stretches I've seen with the Jews are amazing. And let's face it, even the I-Man talked about the time when the monarchs wanted their taxes collected by the Jews, because they were filthy people anyway. And also, the monarchs couldn't touch the filthy lucre, which was the tax money. So they had the Jews go out and grab it. And, of course, what do the peasants do? You know, do they get aggravated at the monarchy? No, they get mad at the tax collectors. I mean, which happens to this very day. But I mean, and so there's one of the things. I mean, I don't think that God's chosen people. Now, I don't believe that whatsoever. But I also believe that they're very convenient pinatas for people to bang. And of course, if we insist upon Rome, because this thing is satanic. It's not Jewish or Catholic or Protestant. It's satanic. Then of course we're called Zionists. But I'm so tired of it now, and it really doesn't matter. Because, I mean, those people are already lost. And I'm sorry to interject that, but I think it needed to be said.
No, it did. I think it was well said. Couldn't it be like a variation of the, you know, shoot the messenger or attack the messenger? You know, if you've got the tax collectors right out in front and center, everybody's going to be concentrating on them. It's like that old simile of what's going on in left field and, you know, the actual stuff's happening in right field, or something along those lines, where it's, you know, it's a shell game.
Of course it is. And I mean, again, the greatest disguise is and we talked about an example I used about that movie, The Usual Suspects, where Kevin
right.
Spacey plays this gimpy person who actually is the mastermind of this whole plot, but because he looks like a defective human being, nobody thinks he could possibly be that. And so he gets away with it. And that's what we're saying here. I mean, the fact that they have done this pretty much in masquerade and behind curtains, you know, obviously they're very good at what they do, and the record will not show, for the most part, that they're the ones involved, although you will find crossovers at times, because they were very politically involved in a lot of nations.
Yes.
But
I was just going to say, isn't that like the evil one himself? He's the most subtle beast of the field, as I've said before. He's not going to come across like some ugly ogre. He's going to make himself look like some kind of a pleasing, you know, benign persona.
Yeah, and I mean, so he's happy as heck that everybody, or not everybody, but there's a great mass of people who want to blame the Jews for everything. That's exactly what he wants, because it deflects attention to him and the actual parties that he has used across the several millennia.
Yes. Now, I have another quote here by Emanuel M. Josephson. He was the American physician and historian, and he says that Jesuit-trained Illuminist Adam Weishaupt and his fellow Jesuits cut off the income to the Vatican by launching and leading the French Revolution, by directing Napoleon's conquest of Catholic Europe, and by eventually having Napoleon throw Pope Pius VII in jail at Avignon until he agreed, as the price for his release, to reestablish the Jesuit order. This Jesuit war on the Vatican was terminated by the Congress of Vienna and by the secret 1822 Treaty of Verona, unquote.
Right. The thing is, the Jesuits have been around since the late 16th century.
Right.
Under different names, but Loyola's society. but they did not necessarily hold sway with the Vatican for some time. And they also got kicked out of a lot of nations, but they never give up. So by 1822, the papacy finally understood that they really needed the Jesuit order. And that is, the Jesuits are the ones who have hijacked the Vatican from that point on. So from 1822 onward, the Jesuits get a great deal of traction in starting to infiltrate other nations, and of course always under the guise of supposedly proselytizing, but that was not their aim. And I tell you what, anybody who looks at the fictional novel, I mean it's a novel, okay, it's redundant, but the historical novel Shogun by Clavell will realize that that was all about the Jesuits being in Japan. So, and also if you see The Mission, that's another movie that addresses it somewhat. So I mean their footprints are across history through centuries, but the United States is the one nation that I know of that laughs at the thought that the Jesuits could be running the show.
And not only laughs, but holds in contempt anyone who could actually deign to believe such a thing.
And by the way, the Sutton book was published in 98.
Okay. John Adams, the second president of the United States, and this is something that was was discussed by The Informer, and I figured it was worth revisiting here, where he says, quote, "My history of the Jesuits is not eloquently written, but it is supported by unquestionable authorities, and is very particular and very horrible. The Jesuit order's restoration, that was in 1814 by Pope Pius VII, is indeed a step toward darkness, cruelty, despotism, and death. I do not like the appearance of the Jesuits. If there ever was a body of men who merited eternal damnation on earth and in hell, it is the society of Ignatius de Loyola," unquote. And I just want to make it clear that I'm not here to bash Jesuits. I'm not here to bash the Catholic Church. I'm just here to call a spade without stubbing our toe on one. If we can look at what's really going on, if we can look at the outlay as it exists, I'm fine with that if I can realize some very unpleasant truths and conclusions. It's just like when I go to the doctor. Doctor, give it to me straight. Let me know what the real skinny is. And that's fine. But it's like that old saying. I can't remember who said it, but it goes like this. Senator, don't piss on my leg and tell me it's raining.
Let's just say this, that Satan has always been a persecutor of those who follow Jesus Christ. And he's used secular forms to persecute, dating back to, I mean, the time even with Moses, and also the search for Jesus, for the baby Jesus, to prevent him from being what he came here for. And after a while, I mean, the Roman Empire fell, but the next biggest empire that there was after that, I mean, as far as length and being far flung, was Britain. And so they carried the torch for Rome. I mean, that's why you get King George calling himself the Elector of the Holy Roman Empire. And my point is that we now in the United States have had that more or less devolve upon us, being used perhaps in a way that we think is righteous, but it's absolute opposite. So I would say that for the most part, Britain kind of babysat the Roman Empire until it could rise again, which it's on its way. And now you're going to see both the spiritual and the governmental join together. I mean, whatever Pope's down there, it makes no difference to me. The Pope is just a figurehead like presidents are.
The white Pope, yes.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, okay, say what you want to say. It's what's going on behind that. But, I mean, obviously with what's being said, there's a great move now to try to swell the numbers of Roman Catholics and bring them into the church, where basically what this guy is saying is that anything goes. So,
yeah.
But be that as it may. However, you know, there is somebody who sits on the top of this whole conspiracy, and we're telling you that most directly it is those in the Society of Jesus and everyone else who's underneath that umbrella. I mean, it's a structural hierarchy just like anything is. I mean, you can remember the old flow charts they used to do in the Mafia. Well, I mean, it's the same thing here. So, but for people to turn around like Jones and point to the Bilderbergs, it's like, give me a break, will you? You know?
Jones, just another beautiful example of Jones and his I almost want to call it pathology. Just sort of an aside, his behavior at the there was a demonstration, I believe it was in Austin, a Second Amendment demonstration, how he just came in and completely sabotaged that whole thing.
Yeah.
Just more some really strange behavior on the part of that guy.
Look, the Patriot idiots who follow him have already neutralized. It's already done for them. If people have to believe, have to follow somebody so badly, then they're of no use either. All they are just another herd on the other side of the street. They're as bad as the dumbhead masses they make fun of, because they've already been taken also with that Pied Piper. Am I jealous of him? Absolutely not. I mean, I had to turn him off after like 2 years of listening to him, because he's driving me crazy. All the other stuff that's come out in the meantime is just another whole thing, but I knew that guy was stinky. So at any rate, but, he sends people down side streets. He's got people thinking they can vote in good government, so they've already been neutralized. They're not going anywhere. So,
but I think that you and Theo had a very interesting discussion about how he was basically, essentially, inserted into the road to form a roadblock of sorts to keep any potential or any movements from going anywhere.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll say this real quickly and we'll get on, and that is I was there back in the day when there were some attempts by other personages to try to do something and have like a network. I mean, think about what the Tea Party did in the time that it did it, all right? You don't need that much money, although they were backed heavily by the Koch brothers. But we could have done it. But he did not want to know it. He resisted any kind of attempt to make any kind of network. He could have sat on top of it. I wouldn't mind it. But he didn't want to play nice with other children. So he made sure that it never happened. And then by 2003, when he came into the money, then it was pretty clear to me that he was doing somebody's bidding. And I'm not saying the government. It doesn't really matter. It could be crypto, Christians or whatever. But, and he's had a deep Opus Dei background also in his family. And of course, he's not going to direct anything toward the Jesuits, and neither will Slick Stan Monteith, afraid of losing listenership. So there you go.
That's true.
And that's from his own mouth, by the way. That's from Monteith's mouth.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. I didn't know that.
No, he told two listeners of mine years ago did not tell them about me, and I had Stan on. Stan's a walking infomercial. He is so good at inserting him. I said, okay, press record, we're ready, and Stan took the show. And I bought books from him and everything like that, and I don't mind it, but Stanley likes to make money, and he likes to do certain things in the shadows as well. And he told two listeners, longtime listeners, and he confided one from Ohio, who said, I can't get involved with that. I'll turn off listeners. And that's the difference between doing things for profit and doing things not for profit. Like it matters to me if I lose 5 listeners or 50 or 500. What do I care? I've lost more and gained them back a million times. But the thing is, nobody bought my rear end. So.
That's right.
All right. So anyway, enough about that, but. Please go on.
Sure. I wanted to mention
the Jesuits with me.
Gee, I hadn't noticed. No. John Adams, this was a letter to Thomas Jefferson, May 19th, 1821. This was a book, I believe it was James A. Haught, H-A-U-G-H-T, 2,000 Years of Disbelief. And he asked, can a free government possibly exist with the Roman Catholic religion? Unquote. And this was another one from George Seldes, S-E-L-D-E-S, The Great Quotations. I think this was also from James Haught's book. He said, I almost shudder at the thought of alluding to the most fatal example of the abuses of grief which the history of mankind has preserved, the cross. Consider what calamities that engine of grief has produced, unquote. And these sayings are just sprinkled and peppered through many of the old archives and letters and writings, centuries. And, of course, I am reminded of Abraham Lincoln and his discussions with, Samuel Morse? Chiniquy, yes. Yep. And for the people who have said to me and have sent many of the, as I've said before, Killer Egghead for Christ emails, I've sent them some of this information, and I just never hear a thing back. It's like I said, insert crickets in the background. And I actually found this in writing, the Treaty of Tripoli. Okay, this was the Treaty of Peace and Friendship between the United States of America and the Bayan subjects of Tripoli, of Barbary. And it was a treaty that was between the U.S. and Tripolitania. And it was signed at Tripoli, 4th of November, 1796, and I think in 1797 in Algiers, yes, January 3rd. Now, it was submitted to the Senate by Adams, and it received ratification unanimously from the U.S. Senate, and this was in June of 1797, and it was signed by Adams, taking effect. It took effect. It was the law of the land on June 10th of 1797. And, of course, we well remember the statement in the Constitution that treaties shall be the supreme law of the land. And, you know, for a few centuries up to the treaty, you know, the sea lanes of the Mediterranean, they were pretty heavily preyed on. You had North African Muslim pirates, you know, of course, the Barbary pilots, privateers, hostages. Were captured by the Barbary pirates. You know, they were either ransomed, they were forced into slavery. And some of the captives did what they called, went Turk. They converted to Islam, which made life a little bit easier for them. But for the Christian captives, that was bad news. They were treated extremely terribly. So, and of course, you know, during the Revolution, you know, the colonies were protected by the Brits. And... yeah, you had the French, of course, they got involved. But the treaty itself, as I was looking at this, almost struck me as sort of a deal where the United States was sort of buying through specie, trinkets, gold, silver, jewelry, the, I don't know if emir is the proper word. They did specifically refer to him as something else. I can't remember what it was. But the treaty itself wasn't a very long treaty, really. It was pretty concise. Let me see if I can find it here. I've got a whole slew of PDFs here. A whole slew of them. Oh, my gosh. Let me see. Oh, and as an aside, I did try to find another reference to the Jesuits in the Anti-Federalist Papers, and that was the only one I was able to find. Okay. And this is probably going to surprise those Christians who believe that America was founded on Christian principles, but I'm going to read some of these articles. And let's see here. I will read several of them. Not all of them, but several of them. Article 1. There is a firm and perpetual peace and friendship between the United States of America and the Bayan subjects of Tripoli of Barbary, made by the free consent of both parties and guaranteed by the most potent Dey and Regency of Algiers. That was Article 1. Okay, let me see here. All right, let me go up to Article 5. A citizen or subject of either party having bought a prize vessel condemned by the other party or by any other nation, the certificate of condemnation and bill of sale shall be sufficient passport for such vessel for 1 year, this being a reasonable time for her to procure a proper passport. Okay, let me bump up to Article 8. If a vessel of either party shall be attacked by an enemy within gunshot of the forts of the other side or of the other, she shall be defended as much as possible. If she be in port, she shall not be seized or attacked when it is the power of the other party to protect her. And when she proceeds to sea, no enemy shall be allowed to pursue her from the same port within 24 hours after her departure. Now, I'm not reading these in any particular rhyme or reason. I just don't want to read all of them because there's, you know, it would take up a lot of time. But here's the real kahuna. This is Article 11. This was in the English version, and it was said that it was not in the Arabic version because there were two versions of the Tripoli Treaty. One was in Arabic. One was in Christian. Or, I'm sorry, one was in Christian. One was in English. And funny I should use that word because it does relate. Okay, this is Article 11. Quote, as the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, as it has in itself no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of Muslims, they spell it here Muslimen, M-U-S-S-E-L-M-E-N, but they mean Muslims. And as the said states shall never have entered into any war or act of hostility against any Mohammedan nation, it is declared by the parties that no pretext arising from religious opinions shall ever produce an interruption of the harmony existing between the two countries, unquote.
E-I-E-I-O.
There it is in black and white. This was unanimously passed by the Senate. This was signed by Adams. And there it is. I never learned that in school. Now, it was signed and sealed at Tripoli of Barbary the third day of Jumad in the year of the Hijra, H-I-G-E-R-A, 1211, corresponding with the fourth day of November, 1796, by Yusuf Basha Mohammed Bey, Suleiman Kaya, Mamet, treasurer, Galil, general of the troops, Ahmed, minister of marine, Mohammed, C-O-M-L of the city. I'm not sure what C-O-M-L means. Ahmet, chamberlain. Mamet, secretary. Ali, chief of the divan. Okay, and then there was another signing, fourth day of Argib, 1211, corresponding with the third day of January, 1797, by Hassan Basha Day and the agent plenipotentiary of the United States of America, Joel Barlow. And, yeah, I have this whole thing, and let's see here.
Well, send me the link for it, too, and I'll put it up with the
I certainly will, yes. And that, and oh, by the way, this is from the Avalon Project.
Okay.
Okay. Now, there were some saying, well, it didn't mean what it said it meant, or it didn't mean what it was written. And I have the 1828 dictionary, Webster's Dictionary. And let's look at what the word government means. Government, noun, direction, regulation. These precepts will serve for the government of our conduct. Two, control, restraint. Men are apt to neglect the government of their temper and passions. Three, the exercise of authority. Direction and restraint exercised over the actions of men in communities, societies, or states. The administration of public affairs according to established constitution, laws, and usages, or by arbitrary edicts. Prussia rose to importance under the government of Frederick II. And let's see, it goes on, of course. But basically, words mean things, and they said it right there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Yes, and I do have several links, and I will send you those. But I'm finding all kinds of different things here about the Jesuits and their influence throughout history. And, of course, there was that list of how many books? 70, 80 now? Is that what we're up to?
Somewhere between 70 and 80, yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I didn't throw everything in there that just said something about the Jesuits. And, you know, we vetted them. And so I just didn't throw everything against the wall because, you know, I thought it would stick. So the ones that we've had there, either Theo or myself have read either all of or part of. And I'm in the process, and I really should get a move on, to identify which ones can be read online, which, of course, is easiest for everyone to access. Because it's an amazing thing. And also the references to them that really don't have anything to do with, like, world domination. They're players all throughout. And I won't give examples of that. We did that in the past, you know, where they pop up all the time.
Yes, they do.
So, all right.
Of course, it was and I almost forgot this. I do remember when the informer was telling you about that speaking of flowcharts, when he said that he had this flowchart, and I have been looking for that. I still have not been able to find it, but where he had that whole flowchart laid out. And if there's anybody out there who can get that, I would love to get my hands on it, where the whole control mm-hmm. was laid out.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we all are familiar with Sinead O'Connor.
With her political statement on Saturday Night Live?
That's right.
Of course, for which she apologized profusely, by the way.
Yes, she did.
And she was forgiven, but she was right.
Yes. Let me see if I can talk about, because I did mention the Whiskey Rebellion in a previous installment, several previous installments. And I did mention that Washington became a major distiller after he was president. And, you know, the amount of whiskey he produced was quite amazing. About something like 1799, he produced 11,000 gallons of whiskey worth about $7,500, making him one of the most successful distillers. And in 1799, I'm thinking 7,500 shekels. That was a lot of scuttle.
Mm-hmm.
And the hero worship of Washington really started at a very early time. You know, of course, you had the anti-federalists that were wise to the situation. But shortly after the rebellion was quelled. This was a Pennsylvania soldier, and he really piled it on pretty thickly. And oh, and of course Washington and Hamilton, they outlawed assemblies and the petitioning of government for redress when this whole thing was going on, when they were quashing the rebellion. So they kind of forgot about the Bill of Rights and the Constitution that they supposedly were so high on. Quote, this is the description of Washington. When the sun occasionally broke through the fleecy and obstructing clouds, the field in one part glittered with a forest of muskets and death-pointed bayonets, while in another part streams of lightning flashed from the drawn blades of the gorgeous cavalry. Amidst all this reflected blaze of armory, the man of the people, with a mien intrepid as that of Hector, yet graceful as that of Paris, moved slowly onward with his attending officers, nor once turned his eagle eye from the dazzling effulgence of the steel-clad band. As the heroic sage advanced on his light-moving steed along the line, which was mute with admiration and respect, our standards involuntarily bowed their heads, while their flags chaunted to the passing gale in unison with the trumpet's clangor and the wild music of the martial field. The scene was augustly picturesque and inspiring. My imagination caught fire, and I thought myself a second Homer, born to sing the praises of the American patriot and hero. Thus transported, I beheld as he retired, 15 blazing suns encircle his elevated brows. In the center sat Justice with her sword in balance, giving way to meek-eyed Mercy with extended arm, unquote. Should have worn my waders for that one.
Yeah, roll up your pants, go on with your story.
Okay. And this is from the book I've been referring to, Whiskey Rebels, The Story of a Frontier Uprising by Leland D. Baldwin. And this is in Chapter 14, The Aftermath. He has quite a write-up about demeanor and attitude of Washington himself as he Leland Baldwin describes him as throwing a bone of discord to the political dogs. And in 1794, this was the 20th of November, he addresses Congress, and in his message, he expresses horror at the insurrection And this is beautiful. This would really kind of crack me up. He cast the onus squarely upon, quote, certain self-created societies, unquote. I mean, what color is your kettle, George? You know, here you had these societies that were active right up to the time of the revolution. And here he is, you know, several years later, banging on the very thing that he previously exalted in.
Well, I mean, they had problems with those societies in the first third of the 19th century, when that whole hubbub about the anti-Masonic party and all that.
Yes.
I mean, if that's what you're referring to, I mean, and of course, they, again, are the ones that are held out for public excoriation. But, again, you have other ones that are at work also, to include Rosicrucians, and of which George was a member.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the Pennsylvania Democratic Society. And let's see. The abuse was largely leveled against the Pennsylvania Democratic Society, but that society pointed out that it had not said anything that had not also been said by a respectable minority in the House of Representatives. In the latter place, it had even been predicted that the excise would create dangerous uneasiness in some part of the country, and the Pennsylvania Society had never gone that far in its statements. Washington's message found a ready echo in the Senate, and a resolution was passed approving its sentiment, but there was a rebellion in the House, where the majority refused to adopt a reply specifically using the phrase self-created society. The struggle lasted for a week while curiosity stood, and I have a quote here, a tiptoe on all our post roads, unquote, to quote one of the House members. Giles of Virginia pointed out that there was scarcely a citizen who did not belong to a self-created society. Methodists, Friends, Philosophical, or boldly tweaking the lion's tail, even the Society of the Cincinnati. The House, he pointed out, was no place to argue the merits or demerits of the democratic societies. Did the members, quote, imagine that their censure, like the wand of a magician, would lay a spell on these people, unquote? It had been, quote, alleged as the very worst trait in the character of democratic societies, that they began their business after dinner, bolted their doors, and voted in the dark. This was a very alarming and detestable species of conduct. But Mr. Chairman, and Giles pointed up to the room above where the notoriously exclusive Senate sat, said, quote, is there no other place where people bolt their doors and vote in the dark, unquote? And, of course, I went right back to the Constitutional Convention, where that's exactly what they did. They bolted their doors, they went to the second floor, and they had their proceedings in secret. And here's Washington, you know, a few years later, banging that very conduct.
Well, I mean, above all else, don't we know that politicians are inveterate double talkers?
Of course.
I mean, they're all phonies. They say one thing out in front of you, and they do something else, you know, behind their backs.
Yeah.
And I mean, so, I mean, how could you even listen to any of them and actually take their word for it? But I don't know at this juncture if this is the right time to ask this. I'm gonna go ahead and do it. If you don't want to address it right now, believe me, don't do it. It's okay. But it's come to my mind that one of the reasons why they allowed the Bible in the classroom for however far we go back is actually, and especially when the schools became more secularized, if you will, with kind of national curriculums. Excuse me. The reason why that Bible was in there, even though it was an affront perhaps to Jews and well, there were no really Muslims around at the time, but to non-Christians or whatever, and that is because they had to create and maintain, it was already created, they had to maintain the belief that the United States was special in the eyes of God, and therefore whatever this nation did had to be okay. It gave them license to kill.
Could that especially not be underscored by the inclusion of Romans 13?
All right, now, I mean, for everyone who doesn't know what that's in there, I mean, yes, I'll tell you what, to this day, I've had rather technicolor discussions with people about what that all means, and a lot of it comes down to the word ministers, which is used in a secular sense there, just like you would have in England or Canada with the ministries of. Also with the word ordained, that does not mean anointed. Okay. Oh, well, so that, of course, Christians mean that they should take office and turn this place into a theocracy. Yeah, you're right. There's a misinterpretation of Romans 13, and it's deliberate. And it's not... You know, it's not what Paul's intent was, although it wasn't Paul who, you know, actually cooked that all up. That's another whole thing. But no, you're right. It's misinterpreted, and they run with it. So yes, that's correct. And people don't ask questions either. You know, I mean, they don't even go back and say these guys were Christians, and how come they were racist and they were sexist, especially in the creation of the Constitution. You know, and then, of course, you could genocide natives, Americans, and that's what we talked about that ad nauseum. And that was okay. Like, somehow that was collateral damage.
And, of course, now we have the Treaty of Tripoli, where they come right out in black and white and say, this was not a country founded on Christianity.
Now, who actually wrote that?
I'm not sure who wrote it. It might have been. I believe so, yes.
All right.
I do think it was Barlow, yes. And... this was a further discussion after the Whiskey Rebellion. This was McDowell, was one of the attendees. And he said, and this is when he was basically criticizing Washington and the Federalists. He said, quote, "Your wanton laws begotten in darkness first raise the insurrection," unquote. And here I like how Baldwin describes what happened next. "The Federalists scurried for Washington's coattails as a family of chicks caught in the hail scramble under their mother's wings. Gentlemen, gentlemen, softly, if you please," they said in effect. "If we do not support the president, will not our silence be interpreted as criticism of that great and good man?" And so successful were those tactics that more than one critic felt forced to deliver, quote, "an elegant panegyric on the character and conduct of the president," unquote, before launching into his speech of dissent with the address. So even back then, there was hero worship of Washington, and of course some of the anti-federalists did mention Washington by name in a very disparaging light, Cato being one of them, where he sort of sneered when he said Washington in his text. You could just see the look on his face as looking like he wanted to barf.
There were always, and there always will be, I get frustrated with this, so excuse me, but there's always going to be the beauty pieces on all the principles. I'll give you an example, and it's no different than it was in the day of Washington, and from that point onward, okay? And that is, you will have stories that come out, like with George Bush, and I still hang on to that Newsweek, where
yes.
Bush has got his head bowed and his folded hands up to his mouth, to his chin, and it says, is Bush too Christian, you know, or something like that, you know, to be president. And I mean, are you serious?
Excuse me while I hurl.
Like, what a profligate. But you know, that's going to go down in the record, that he was a Christian president. That's the whole thing. 8 years of that guy, you know, drunk on his butt most of the time, and of course always having excuses made for him. I'm sure he's a fun guy. But I mean, don't tell me that he was Christian with all that he presided over, including his dad.
That's right.
And the other sons as well. But you see, that's what's going to go down in the history books and the popular stuff that, what's those characters? I mean, I used to like them, and then I realized they're full of crap too. Doris Kearns.
Oh, Kearns and Goodwin?
Well, whoever the one is that she always pops up talking about presidents and all this other stuff. I mean, all she gives, Doris Kearns, is that it? I don't know. I don't know what his name is. I forget.
Oh, no, I think it's Doris Kearns Goodwin. That's who it is. Yeah, it's one person.
And the other one whose father was a heavy hitter too. But they always bring them out, and they give you the sanitized version of what was going on. I mean, that's why
not Mika Brzezinski, is it?
Oh, no, definitely not. Are you kidding me? she's got enough going on for herself.
Yeah.
Being Ziggy's daughter. No, I forget the guy's name. I can see it. He's got black licorice hair and, you know, anyway. But they come out and they give you that stuff, you know, and they're like really deep in history about him, and they know all these factoids, and everybody has him on when they want to talk about presidents, or she'll pop up now because she's a Red Sox fan, so that'll be cool.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that isn't happening. I went back and forth with Phelps about this. And he gives me his stuff. I'm going, look, there was all kinds of great things said about – it was all PR stuff, man. I said, come on, take a look at their actions and what they did, and then frame what they said as to whether or not they were hypocrites, if they ever said it at all. You know, or they were just, you know, same old politicians. You know, he believed there was this halcyon time in America when everything was fine, and then all of a sudden it got corrupted. No, man, it was corrupted from the beginning because that's the nature of government. Sorry.
It's the nature of human nature. And the thing is, I have to plead guilty to being swayed by that belief, too. That, you know, everybody in that day sort of flew around and walked around with halos and angels' wings. And guess what, Eric? That's not what happened. And, of course, that dovetailed quite well with the scales being taken from my eyes when I learned about what the real deal was.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we have to get through our heads, that we've gotten managed news right from the very beginning. But my point, when I asked you that question a while ago, and that was, to me, the reason why they allowed the Bible in there for no other reason but to get it through everyone's heads, whether you were a Christian or not, that Jehovah loves the United States and we can do whatever we want. That's the only reason it was there. Now they can take it out because it never meant anything anyway. And like I said, Christians don't need to have a reading in homeroom as we all did back in the old days. Nobody cares. Nobody's paying attention anyway. So
no, I went to Catholic.
You did?
Yeah, Catholic schools all my life. And so, you know, it was just sort of de rigueur. It was the chapter du jour,
we
read every day.
Right, and nobody listened. So, I mean, you went up
and
you read
it. A bunch of kids.
Right. But the thing is, now they can pull it out because the damage has been done. And now you have also these Christian organizations who believe that there is righteous warfare that's allowed for in the New Testament, in the New Covenant, and that you have to fight to defend Israel. When Jesus Christ made it very clear, you guys don't fight for anything, and especially you don't fight to defend me. Oh, can we just walk a little bit further with that dictum? I mean, what don't they get? But they just blow through all that stuff, and they pull out all the warlike passages from the Old Testament, and it's like, no, man, he came here to vacate a lot of what was in the Old Testament because it's a new era.
Go ahead.
No, the last thing I want to say, and then I say this, and someone says to me, well, God is always the same. He never changes. It's like, I understand that, but do you understand? We're not under the Old Testament, so why do we have the New Testament? We're not under the Old Covenant, so why did he give us a New Covenant? He didn't change, we did. Or because we didn't, he had to do something about it. I'm telling you. I mean, it's brainwashing, like, just as bad as Scientology or LaRusians or Amway.
We rejected his word a long time ago, and we're reaping the price for it now.
Oh,
and we have been for a long time.
Yeah. No, that's why it's going to be a real street brawl when it comes down to it, because Angie was always got really her undies in a wad about this because she just hated Israel. And I'm like, Angie, don't you understand? They're playing their part like we play our part. That's all that is. It's all showbiz. It's theatrics. And I know what it's going to lead us to, but don't you understand? That's the script. To get mad,
yes,
get mad at Greenlanders. I mean, who cares?
You know, be angry at the sun.
Yeah, I mean, they're playing their part. Do you think we don't get it? Of course we do. Because she's like, can't we see? Meaning the government. I'm like, of course they can see. But, I mean, it's the script. Get it through your head. And we are.
Well, here's something, too, that, you know, perhaps Israel was inaccurately named.
Of course it was.
Perhaps it should have been named Judah.
The whole thing is a phony construct. But, again, that's also prophesied in the scripture as well. I mean, the Hinton's going to take place there to a great extent. But don't think Israel's going to come at us with a scratch on it. I mean, they're going to pay a price, and so are we. But unfortunately, if you believe in human beings being human beings, I mean, the Islamic world is going to be decimated.
Yep. And yes, it will be.
And I'm not happy about that. It's not that at all. It's just that there's going to be a high toll taken the next time around, and war is always used to depopulate, but also take care of, shall we say, certain sex.
Look at the Balfour Declaration, the Lavon Affair, just a lot of the things throughout history that have been signatures of this kind of thing.
But, you know, does anybody, I mean, now I'm hearing about this British Israelism from some people who need a checkup from the neck up. And it's like, I mean, do you think the Brits were the only ones down in the Middle East screwing around? The Germans were there. The French were there. They triparted Iraq for a time. You know, I mean, the Germans talked the Ottomans into fighting with them. We've never left those people alone. One of the reasons Iraq always hated Kuwait, because guess who dug it? Who carved out Kuwait from Iraq so they could have a port to ship out oil? Good old British Petroleum. You know, who made Jordan?
Yeah. Yep.
So you talk about the Balfour. Well, yeah, the Balfour Declaration. That's what you just mentioned, right?
Yes.
The McMahon Pledge is another one, and the Sykes-Picot Agreement is another, and that's French-born.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, look, who is the West? But you know, it's always been that way. I mean,
scratch a mullah, you get a British agent, pretty much.
You know, the West has always been in there. It's been like this since 1000 A.D. Oh, we're going to go down and proselytize Muslims by killing our asses. Oh, okay. You know, that makes sense. It's been like this forever, and it continues to be. And we're, of course, going to be led to, I don't know if you want to call it Armageddon or not, but there's going to be a really nasty duke out in what Mackinder called the heartland, in which Brzezinski called the grand chessboard.
Yes.
So I just want to give you a warning. You got about 4 minutes.
Okay, well, I think I've got just the thing to wrap it up with. And I have to go back real quickly to that chicken soup for the soul that you referred to, the Armageddon. That was hysterical. This was written by a farmer and planter. You know, we just read and studied a bit more of the hero worship that even happened back then of Washington. But of course, now we have the other side of the coin, where a farmer and planter said, quote, "I revere the characters of some of the gentlemen that composed the convention at Philadelphia, yet I think they were human and subject to imposition and error, as well as the rest of mankind. You lost 8 or 10 years of your lives and labor by the last war. And you were left at last with your debts and encumbrances on you. And numbers of you were soon after the close of it sued and harassed for them. Your persons have been put into a loathsome prison. And others of you have had your property sold for taxes, and sometimes for one-tenth of its former and actual value. And you now pay very grievous and heavy taxes, double and treble what you paid before the war. And should you adopt this new government, your taxes will be great, increased to support their servants and retainers, who will be multiplied upon you to keep you in obedience and collect their duties, taxes, impositions, and excises. Some of you may say the rich men were virtuous in the last war. Yes, my countrymen, they had reason then to be so. Our liberty then was in dispute with a mighty and powerful tyrant. And it was for their interest to promote and carry on the opposition. As long as they could stay at home and send the common people into the field to fight their battles. After the war began, they could not with decency recede, for the sword and enemy were at the very entrances of their gates. The case is greatly altered now. You conquered the enemy, and the rich men now think to subdue you by their wiles and arts, or make you or persuade you to do it yourselves. Their aim, I perceive, is now to destroy that liberty which you set up as a reward for the blood and treasure you expended in the pursuit of an establishment of it. They well know that open force will not succeed at this time, and have chosen a safer method by offering you a plan of a new federal government contrived with great art and shaded with obscurity, and recommended to you to adopt, which if you do, their scheme is completed, the yoke is fixed on your necks, and you will be undone perhaps forever, and your boasted liberty is but a sound. Farewell, be wise, be watchful, guard yourselves against the dangers that are concealed in this plan of a new federal government. Signed, a farmer and planter."
Yeah, didn't he hit it on the head?
I'll say, in spades.
Well, you were right. That's a great thing to go out on. That was perfect. So, Eric, listen, thanks a lot for coming back for Phantasms 12. We're going to continue this. I know that you had told me that there's a lot more information that you were hoping to impart today, but you had a very ambitious schedule. And so I hope you don't mind that bleeds into the next one because there's plenty there for it.
Not at all, Al. Thanks a lot. It's always good.
Motorcycles.